So today the London Buddhist Vihara is full.
It's both overfull.
Halls.
Yes.
So I want to say a few words to welcome you all, and also I would like to welcome our very special speaker, Ajahn Brahm, who needs no introduction from me actually. But it is customary for us to say a few words actually. Ajahn Brahm of Vansu Mahathera is one of the world renowned Buddhist monk. But very important, he is very familiar to this area.
Yes.
As he was a child, used to live nearby in Acton with his family.
And he used to go to school in Hammersmith.
In Hammersmith, Latimer, upper school.
Latimer school, yes.
And yes.
This was before I became a monk, had many girlfriends in this area. I hope they're not here this evening and telling stories about me. It's true.
After his school Latimer studies, he won a scholarship to study theoretical physics at Cambridge University.
Yeah, I was there this morning. So it was very lovely being in Cambridge again and seeing some of the old haunts I went to. And gave a talk last night at the Cambridge University Buddhist Society, because that's where I started off. So like gratitude. So you always like to look after those who looked after you, and also to come to this temple, because this is where I grew up. This is my, if anything, this is my local temple.
Yeah. No need to introduce.
Yeah.
We are honored to have ours.
A local monk.
Ajahn Brahm also.
A local monk.
Yes, local monk. I am foreigner. So, actually, I don't take your time, okay? You are very welcome. It's a great privilege for all of us to listen to you today. A lot of people actually wanted to come. Unfortunately, some of them have trouble in traveling. But so far, many people have come as your followers.
Yeah, as my stalkers.
you are the most favorite some of the audience. So I'm very thankful and grateful for you to come and Hiranti the Silva, she coordinated your speech here. I'm very thankful to her as well. With my respect, Ajahn, I would like to invite you today. Thank you so much.
No, very good. I have this one here, sir. So. Excellent. Well, as you know, sometimes when you give a talk, you say, it's my pleasure to be here. And you don't really mean it. But this time, I really do mean it. Because I got so many memories of this area. And it's great to be back in sort of Chiswick, Acton, Hammersmith, this area. And it's also wonderful to be able to give a talk again here. I have been, again, traveling around again. And on this particular trip, started off here in London just about 2 weeks ago and gave a talk at the Thames Buddhist Vihara and the London Buddhist Society before going off to Canada to teach at the University of Toronto and then McGill and then Dalhousie universities. And it's fascinating in some of those universities, in Dalhousie and also in University of Toronto, I was giving lectures on Buddhism and mental health and psychology, because this is just a huge growing area in our Western world where some of these great teachings of the Buddha are being at last valued and are being brought into mainstream Western culture in medicine, in obviously mental health, and also into business as well. And it's great to see that. Now, Buddhism comes to a country, you know, like England, and it actually spreads, you know, into areas of life where it can really make a huge difference. And it's great to be part of that. And after that, went to Hamburg. And even there, in the University of Hamburg, you know, we gave a talk where many people came because there's an interest, you know, even in the academia, of, you know, what Buddhism can offer. So you can see this is a huge step for Buddhism in our modern world, you know, to go out to these universities and other places like business schools. I've just got an invitation next February to go to the Google campus in San Francisco for the whole day, actually to teach, you know, Google, just, you know, how to search properly. And all of those things just show the power of the Dhamma. But when I did give a talk somewhere, one of those places, on the challenges of Buddhism for the 21st century, I mean, that was, I think, was in Dalhousie over in Canada. I didn't make a mention of a friend I have over in Perth, Western Australia, and he is a professor of physics at our local university. Now, because I still really keep a great interest in physics, and many physicists come to my talks, and I manage actually to talk to them, to relate to them, and also to learn from them as well. And this one particular professor, you know, he seems to be so open to Buddhism, and I asked him, you know, aren't you a Buddhist? And he said that he was very interested in Buddhism when he was a young man, maybe 20, 30 years ago. And he actually traveled to Thailand to try and learn some Buddhism. But unfortunately, all he found was a thick mass of rituals which no one could explain to him. And he never learned how to meditate. He was told to bow first of all and light some incense and you know, do some offerings and stuff. And because of that, he left that country thinking that was all there was to Buddhism. And it was such a great waste, you know, that we have these gorgeous teachings and they're not really sort of spread in a very useful, easily understandable, accessible way. And so it's from that experience that, you know, I coined the phrase, you know, that sometimes the cloud of incense smoke obscures the Buddha in some of these temples. You know, the clouds of incense smoke stand for the rituals which we do. And the Buddha statue behind it, you know, the truth, the Dhamma, all these great teachings, you just can't see it because it's clouded by all these rituals. And sometimes that people say, well, what are the rituals of Buddhism? There's not that many rituals which we have to do and keep. And sometimes we wonder where those rituals actually come from. And I know that this is not the Sri Lankan tradition, but the Chinese tradition. Because I went to some of these Chinese temples and Mahayana temples in Singapore, Malaysia, Hong Kong. And I couldn't believe it that when a Chinese person goes into the temple, they've got a big bowl for the incense. And they take the incense and they shake it before they put it into the bowl. Have you ever seen that in Sri Lanka? No, but you go to China, Hong Kong, Taiwan, they always do that. They shake it. And I asked them, you know, why do you do that? They didn't know. They just said, when I went to the temple, my grandmother told me that's what I was supposed to do. I just followed her. And that gave me the answer. Because I think it's also the case in Sri Lanka, there are many Sri Lankans here, the first person which takes you into the temple is your grandmother. And she shows you what to do. And it's the same in Chinese Buddhism. Your grandmother shows you what to do. And there must have been a lot of grandmothers in China or in these places, because they had Parkinson's disease, that they shook their hands when they put the thing into the bowl. And the children, the grandchildren, thought, that's what I have to do as well. And there we developed the custom of shaking the incense. Because you just follow what other people do without realizing that she's doing that because she can't hold them still. But you may be only 6 or 7 years of age. You hold them still and put them in properly. And so some of these traditions which we have, it's great to understand. Have you seen in those very old temples, you know, people that actually the old, especially the old temples, when you don't have carpets, have wooden floors? You ever notice how highly polished those wooden floors are? No, they're just, and the monks never need to polish them. All they do is have people like you sitting listening to a talk, and every time that you wiggle. You help polish the floor with your big bottoms. And after many hundreds of years, that's why we have very highly polished floors in the temples. Now, of course, there's many other sort of rituals. And one of the rituals which, you know, you have to be very careful of is that it's good to respect the monks and the nuns, but not too much. Because sometimes the monks are treated like royalty. And sometimes the monks don't learn to do things for themselves. And a monk like me never has a chance to have exercise. And I say, I want to walk to the underground station. No, 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 no. We'll give you a lift. Even though it's only 50 meters over there. But fortunately today, I never told anyone how I got here. Because, you know, I got my train ticket. And I got the train from Cambridge down here. Changed here and changed there. And just by myself. I'm old enough to do that by myself now. And it's, you know, a walk from Gunnersbury, which is about a 15-20 minute walk. So today I had exercise. So I'm going to live much longer because no one actually knew how I was coming and didn't pick me up. So please remember, don't treat the monks like royalty. Treat them with respect, but not to the point you don't allow them to have exercise. You don't allow them, you know, to even go on diets, because sometimes, you know, you give monks food and you know, sometimes I don't want to eat it because I've already had enough, and you look at me with these, you know, these what's it called, baby seal eyes, as if I don't take your food it's like cutting off your head, and it's really mean that I don't take your food. So please, you know, just look after the monks, and if they don't take your food, as long as you've offered it, you know, with a pure heart, then that's all that's necessary. In our temple, when the food is offered there, we tell everyone to go out. Because otherwise, you stand round the table and you say, monk, that one, don't take hers, take mine. And they get so bad, you always want them to take yours because you think that's extra merit. In Thailand, they've got the weird idea that whatever you offer to a monk is what your deceased relation gets when they get to heaven. So, one day, it was only about last year, they gave me some offerings in a bucket, quite a lot. And, you know, I received the offerings and you send it down to the attendants who unpack it and put it in the right places. And 5 minutes later, one of the attendants came back and said, did you know, Ajahn Brahm, you have just received a bottle of whiskey. Because they've given the monks a bottle of whiskey, but it was actually hidden under all the other, you know, piricura. And the reason they did that, because if I'd have seen a bottle of whiskey, I would never have accepted it. I'm a good monk. They did that so that I would accept the whiskey, and their father, who really loved drinking, could get some whiskey up in heaven. A total fraud. We don't need to do that. Why, if they're in heaven, why do they need whiskey to celebrate? They're having a good time already. And if they're in the hell realms, they can't get anything anyway, so it's a total waste of time. So anyway, so remember, it's the way that, you know, offerings work. You offer something which is useful. And I'm not quite sure about this monastery, but many Sri Lankan monasteries in London before had whole cupboards full of towels. Because every time they go to your house, you offer a towel. And, you know, a monk can't use a towel in the morning, another towel in the afternoon, another towel in the evening. You know, how long will a towel last? You know, it lasts you for about 3-4 months. So, sometimes people keep offering you so much, you can't use it. So how can you make an offering to a good monk? And this was, you know, this is the real tradition. Now obviously you look after the monastery so they can pay the bills and the monks have enough robes to wear and everything. But in the Mahaparinirvana Sutta, the Buddha once said that you cannot worship and make merit with a monk just by offering candles, incense and flowers. He said the best way, the best offering to make is your practice. That you're actually listening to the monks and actually taking their advice, you know, being kind, being forgiving, keeping your precepts, you know, and doing some meditation, acting compassionately in life, following the advice of the Buddha. That is the best offering anyone can ever make. And it does remind me of an anecdote. When I was visiting Singapore, I go to Singapore a lot, and I've got a franchise there. These days I call my little centers and groups in many other countries Ajahn Brahm's franchises. It's called the Brahm Education Center in Singapore. And we've got my monastery in Perth is called Bodhinyana. Now we have a franchise in Hong Kong, Bodhinyana International Foundation. I'm following the sort of the marketing strategy of McDonald's. Soon there'll be I'm only joking, we don't do things like that. But when I first went to Singapore and I was taking me around all the different temples in Singapore, I went to the Sri Lankan temple in Singapore. I think it was called Mangala Vihara. There's a couple there, but Mangala Vihara was where this event happened. And I was taken around a very beautiful little monastery in the center of Singapore. And at the end, the senior monk asked me to sign the visitor's book. That's what you would do. So he showed me the visitor's book that's over there. That's the visitor's book. Go and sign it. So, you know, I opened the visitor's book and signed my name, and then I put the address. And the next column I read was how much you're donating. Because I picked up the wrong book. This was not the visitor's book. This was a donation book. And I'd already put my name and address down. So if I'd have said nothing, that would be very, very embarrassing. And I didn't have any money because I'm a monk with no money. So what could I do? And so I remembered the Mahaparinirvana Sutra. Know that this is the best way to make offerings to a Buddha, you know, is with your practice. So I wrote down, it must be there somewhere, you know, in their sort of archives, because many, 20, 25 years ago, I wrote down, how much am I giving? I give my whole life. And I thought it was really nice, because that's, you know, that is the offering to do. Give your life to the Dhamma, you know, to service, and you'll never ever regret that. So giving a towel is nothing. Now, giving us sort of a few dollars or a few pounds. I've got to remember where I am. So I'm not in Germany now, so it's not euros. It's not Canadian dollars. It's not Australian dollars. It's pounds in this country. So you can give a, you know, a few pounds. That's good, but the best thing you can give, you know, is, you know, your goodness. And I must admit, as a teacher who has helped many people, and sometimes people say, thank you, Ajahn Brahm, for saving my life. Many people have done that. I say, what can I give you, Ajahn Brahm? I say, you keep on being kinder. You know, forgive more people. Be a bit more compassionate. You know, keep your precepts better. And then that will be your gift to me. And that's worth much more than anything else. And that makes me the most happy. When I see people living in peace and harmony together. And one little story of how to live in peace and harmony together. I think some of these stories I must have told in the Thames Vihara a couple of weeks ago. But there was not that many people there, so I hope that you didn't hear this. And if you did hear this, I know most people who come to the Sri Lankan temples are old. So I hope that you've got Alzheimer's, at least enough to forget the story I told about 10 days ago. And that was this couple. And apparently they were living in India. They were German. They had been married for 2 years. And they were always arguing together. And you know what it's like, being married? You know, the old story is, in the first year of marriage, the wife listens to the husband. In the second year of marriage, the husband listens to the wife. In the third year of marriage, the neighbors listen to both of you. You're arguing so loud. And that's the nature of marriage. And so, and those of you who are in a marriage and you argue, you hate that. Both of you. Why do we do this? It really sounds, it feels yucky. This is the person you actually love and like them, your partner in life, but you get into these bad habits. They're in a bad speech towards one another. And it's all because, you know, you want to be right. And so this couple, they came up with this beautiful solution, which I'm telling many people around the world now. And that was that when they were having an argument, before it got too bad, they would stop and look at the calendar, especially the day of the month. And if it was an odd number, like today is the 29th, the female will be right. If it was an odd number, like tomorrow, the 30th, or the 2nd, 4th, 6th, 8th, 12th, then he would be right. And that meant that they didn't need to argue. Who's right and who's wrong is already decided. It's the 6th today, that's an even number, so the husband's right. And it makes it nice and even, because, you know, husband's right half the time, the wife's right half of the time. And actually, the wife's right a little bit longer than the husband. But I think the husband's very happy to give an extra couple of days a year to the wife. But at least it settles the argument. Because you don't have to keep trying to justify and find out who's right and who's wrong. And that goes on forever. And it causes very, very bad ideas and emotions in your heart. And would it be a wonderful way just to solve all marital problems? Look at the calendar. It's, remember, odd day, she's right. Even day, he's right. Now, I've been telling that story a little bit for the last few years, for the last few months, and someone came up with a problem. And that problem is, what if it's a gay marriage? And I haven't found a solution to that yet. Because they're all right on the same day, and they're all wrong on the same day. But anyway, you know, that's only a small proportion of marriages in this world. But when we find out just, you know, the nice way of these rituals, then it makes it much easier to perform. Now, one of the other rituals which we have in Buddhism is the bowing. Now, I'm saying this because there's many Westerners who come to this vihara, this temple, they're interested in Buddhism. But one of the things they always find difficult, you know, is now prostrating to a Buddha. Even worse, prostrating to a monk, you know, or a nun. You know, what am I doing that for, says Westerners. And if you don't know the reason why, then of course, you know, you don't really feel like it's got any meaning. It's just some ritual. So first of all, the first benefit of when we bow three times to a Buddha is you exercise your tummy muscles so well, it stops you getting fat. But of course, you can see it doesn't really work with me. But for those of you who think I am fat, I am not overweight or fat. Because what has happened, it's been 40 years since I ordained. Just a couple, yeah, a week ago, October 23rd, when I first put on the brown robe. Just over 40 years ago now. And every year you're a monk, you know, you grow in compassion and kindness. Every year, your heart gets a little bit bigger. And now I've been a monk for 40 years. My heart is so big, it pushes out my tummy. This is not fat. This is an enlarged heart, made bigger. It's got to go somewhere. It just goes out here. And as a result of that, I haven't seen the hamdro here, but please never trust a skinny monk. The fat ones are the happy ones. Now, okay, that's a bit of fun, but science, I like this bit of science and Buddhism, because I found an article, or someone keeps sending me articles, interesting articles about health, and especially attitudes. And this particular article was how it had been found conclusively through very rigorous studies that every time you laugh, you're happy, that your blood vessels actually expand, they get bigger. But if you're miserable, sad or angry, your blood vessels actually contract, they get smaller. So, you know, if you do like eating, you know, oily Sri Lankan food, string hoppers, you know, really greasy stuff, and all sorts of other yuck, muck, And I like fish and chips, okay? That's English muck. If you like eating all of that, if you're angry and upset and you've got thin blood vessels, that gets clogged. In other words, you get heart attacks or strokes because your arteries are really thin and you've got lots of muck going through your blood vessels. But if you laugh a lot and very happy like me, you know, my blood vessels are huge. So I can eat anything and it all just goes through. It's like superhighway. They never have a traffic jam. So, and that answered a very important question, which I always want to know the answer for, is why is it that fat people are usually very happy? It is true. They're jolly. Now, for those of you of my age and generation, remember Robin Hood? Robin Hood and Friar Tuck? He's a really fat guy. You know, he was religious, but he was always very happy and kind. You got another fellow, he's, I don't know how old he is, he's fat and he's almost ancient and really happy and kind. Santa Claus. So the happy ones, the fat ones, have to be happy because the fat, miserable ones died a long time ago. Narrow blood vessels, a lot of guck, they have to die. So if you are a little bit overweight, please bow a lot and laugh a lot, and that will save your life. And there's a lot to be said about that, because another little story, there was a fellow from Yorkshire. He was very old, maybe in his late 70s, and eventually he got cancer. The cancer spread. They went through all the treatments, but there comes a time when it's not worth doing any more treatments. So they put him in a hospice, you know, a special unit just for people who are dying, so they could give them palliative care, you know, pain medications, but nothing else. They weren't going to try and keep them alive anymore. Just let them die peacefully with dignity and with their family around. So he was taken to the hospice, you know, to die. And the first day in the hospice, you know, when the nurses asked what he wanted for dinner, you know, he told the nurses all the things he couldn't eat because he had diabetes, he couldn't eat stuff with sugar, he had cholesterol problems, so he couldn't eat things like butter or fat. He had all these other problems, so he couldn't eat this and couldn't eat that. And the nurse said, "What are you talking about? Are you going to die? The cholesterol's not going to kill you. The diabetes, neither. You got cancer, that's going to kill you, so you can eat whatever you like." He said, "Really?" And that was the first time in about 3 or 4 years he could eat all the greasy, sweet, syrupy, salty foods his wife would never cook for him and tell him off if he did cook, eat them. And so he ate all the food he liked. And 2 weeks later, he was released from the hospice because he got better. That was a true story. You know, the cancer came back 6 months, 10 months later, but he had 6 or 10 months of quality life, eating whatever he liked. Now, that anecdotal story actually tells you something. Now, one of it is not just the food, it's the happiness as well, the joy. Now, that is also important. You don't just live by food, you also live through happiness as well. So if you are going on a diet, please go on a happy diet of laughter. And if you don't know how to laugh and you're very miserable, you can do exercises, because exercises are good for your health. How many people do push-ups in the morning? I do 20 push-ups every morning. Do you believe that's true? Because I can't tell lies. I'm a monk. And my 20 push-ups in the morning, and I encourage you to do the same. I stand in front of the bathroom mirror with my feet maybe 2 foot apart, and I get my 2 fingers to the side of the mouth. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. I do 20 push-ups in front of the mirror. Because this is my job, to give talks and to smile for, and that makes me sort of exercise these muscles. So if people ask me, why are you smiling a lot? It's just exercise. It's training like anything else. So if any of you are miserable, depressed, sick, upset, find a mirror, stand in front of it and do 20 push-ups, please. That has a huge effect. So sometimes I tell these stories, you know, you may think they're just jokes. I tell them as funny stories because that is the same technique which advertising uses. It gets under your radar, you get brainwashed. Because when you see these adverts on TV, you think, no sensible person would ever believe in these stupid adverts. Because they're actually, their pitch, seeming they're low intelligence. And that's why you never suspect that they are actually getting into your brain as well. Of course, and that's why advertising works. And it just, don't think that you're so sophisticated it doesn't work on you. That's a whole trick. To make you feel that it's not influencing you. But it does. So when I tell these funny stories, you may think, oh, it's just a funny story. But I get under your radar. I brainwash you. And it's amazing how many of you, next time you're depressed, will be standing in front of a mirror with your two fingers pushing up. It works. So that's why some of the other traditions and rituals, when people do give sermons, and that's the important part of Buddhism, to teach, for goodness sake, there's great sort of spiritual riches in Buddhism, but let's teach it. And teach it so people can listen and understand and benefit from it. Sometimes, you know, that people think, oh, Ajahn Brahm, you know, you're too superficial, just too easy. I want something deep. But I remember, because last night I was teaching at the Buddhist University Buddhist Society in Cambridge. And I used to go there for 3 years. I was a member when I was a student. And most times when I listened to a talk, and some of them were from Sri Lankan monks, Thai monks too, professors, I'd fall asleep. How many of you, when you go to a bhana, fall asleep? You think you have to go there because you're a Buddhist. You know, you go to Sri Lanka and just you have to listen to a bhana because, you know, that's what you have to do. And you just totally fall asleep. And so, just listening, for the sake of listening, what's the point of that? If you actually get something out of it, get inspired, get something which you can take home and use in your daily life, then great, that is worth doing. And also, now those of you who have seen me many times, I put a lot of energy, you know, into my speeches. I don't just sit there and say, the Buddha taught four noble truths and the Eightfold Path, right? You've heard that already. So you want to do something with a bit more gusto, changing the tone of your voice in order to actually get people alert and listening to you. And that is a skill. So when you actually do listen to a preaching or whatever, make sure that the monk actually gives it some heart and gives it some energy and says interesting things, because otherwise it just doesn't go through at all. So back to the bowing. Okay, it's not just to exercise the tummy muscles. Because when I bow, and I've taught this to Westerners especially, Sri Lankans also, you should listen to this. When I bow, I am bowing to what the Buddha stands for what he symbolizes, just for me. So when I bow the first time, I bow to virtue, to precepts, to ethics. Because I travel around a lot in this world, and you know, you do meet some powerful people. And I value so much ethics, trustworthiness, honesty. And that is so important to me in this world. When you think, how can we make a better world? Can we not trust one another? In other words, we tell the truth, we don't lie. So when other people tell you something, you can actually believe them. And how we can care for one another and protect and not take, you know, from other people. What a wonderful world that would be. No drugs, no violence. Wouldn't that be a beautiful world? And we have little isolated pockets of that in monasteries. It's so beautiful being a monk. And I can be in this temple here. And I know that no one will harm or hurt me. Because these are my brothers and sisters. And it's so freeing to trust each other. So I value virtue so much. I think it's such an important part of our world. You know, that we can trust each other and we can keep our doors unlocked. I often say that where I lived in Creswick Road, just off Horn Lane in Acton, a council flat, my father was very poor. We never locked our doors. The door was always open. Because we never had anything to steal. And also, my father used to say, he used to keep the door open, hoping a burglar might come in, take pity on us and leave something. But at least we could trust one another in those days. And you know, you could, as a kid, you could go walking out on the street, playing all day, your mother wouldn't know where you were, you'd come home in the evening, perfectly safe. And well, those days were beautiful, because we had ethics, trust, and safety. But you know that. Many of you from Sri Lanka, you've been in the maybe villages in the old times, and you could trust each other, and you didn't need to worry about someone stealing anything. And people were honest. And that's something I value so much. I would love to bring back into this world and make it stronger, that when I bow the first time, I bow to virtue. Now, when you bow, it means you're lowering your head. And the Buddha, who is here standing for virtue, is higher than you. And that is a potent psychological recognition of how much you worship, find worth and value in virtuous things. So every time I bow the first time, I bow to virtue, which means I remember how important it is. I raise it above myself, which means that I become more virtuous. Because every time I remember its importance, it gets stronger in me. And that's a great way of remembering the importance. But when it comes to truthfulness, now we have precepts, you know, not to lie. But why is it that people still lie? Because sometimes just taking a precept is not good enough. We need to understand why people tell lies to one another. Why wives lie to their husbands, husbands to their wives, and children to their parents. It happens. And the event which made me understand how lying, you know, is almost impossible to prevent unless we make a few adjustments, you know, to our family life, was when a young Sri Lankan girl in Perth, she's maybe about 18, she came to me. Now, I'd known her since she was really small. You know, her parents brought her to the temple, so I'd seen her grow up. She was about 18, and she said, "Ajahn Brahm, I'm in big trouble." So what is it? He said, "I'm pregnant. I'm pregnant with my boyfriend." I said, "Have you told your mother and father yet?" He said, "No, they will kill me if they find out. That's what I came to you for. Can you please tell them for me?" And at first I felt honored that, you know, I could help somebody. So, you know, I did that later on. But afterwards I thought, why is it that when a girl is in big trouble, why is it she's afraid to tell the people who can help her the most, her parents? Why is it she'll think her parents will kill her? She didn't really mean kill her, but just really give her a hard time and scold her and berate her. It was because the fear of punishment was why she would not tell the truth. And I understood from that experience that punishment is what drives the truth underground. When we're afraid of the consequences of telling the truth, we will lie. So I've been telling a lot of people, especially when I have the privilege to do blessings for young couples who get married, I ask them, "Can you please promise each other from this day on that if your partner tells you the truth, whatever they've done, even if you're embarrassed, upset, hurt by what they've done, as long as it's the truth, now you will respect it and don't punish them or scold them at all. Because they're telling you the truth, they're really asking you, can you help? I've made a terrible mistake, you know, I need your assistance." And you will be there for them to help them. is called amnesty, as long as they tell the truth. If they lie, you can hit them, kick them, well, I don't know, scold them, shout at them, refuse, you know, the dinner for the next 10 days or whatever. I don't know what you do. But if they tell the truth, please don't harm or hurt or scold or punish them. Otherwise, they'll never tell you the truth again. Same, the wife to the husband. As long as you tell me the truth, darling, I will never scold or hurt you. Because we need to learn together. And then you can tell your children that. And this perhaps is the most important. Please tell your sons and daughters, whatever you get up to in life, whatever that is, if son, if you get into drugs, please don't be afraid of coming to tell mum and dad. Because you need our help. And we're here to help you as long as you tell us the truth. And girls, you know, if you're pregnant or whatever happens, a time when you need your parents most of all, you should never feel afraid to go and tell them. Because it's the punishment, or the fear of punishment, is what drives the truth underground. And when there's no truth in a marriage or in a family, there's so many other problems arise as a result. Problems, you know, such as someone being pregnant or getting involved in drugs, that can be solved if the family works together. But if you don't tell each other because you're afraid, where can we make any progress? So that's why it's not just telling the truth, it's understanding why we lie and making sure we don't have to lie in the future. Now, it's not just saying about the drug problem in our modern world. Why do people take drugs in the first place? And when you understand, you know, that they're seeking happiness, you know, in the drug world, why can't they find happiness elsewhere? And sometimes that some of us saying in Hamburg, sort of the monks and the lay people laughing around so much that people think we're drunk. You know, we have a nice time, we're happy, we're joyful, we tell jokes and we laugh. And sometimes people say, you monks, what are you taking? What drug are you on? Dumber drug, that's all. Happiness. So when you actually find an alternative to those illegal substances, which is very natural, a positive attitude in life, good meditation, being kind, being virtuous, being compassionate, you don't need those things. So it's not just taking precepts and say, I will not do this, I will not do that. It's finding out how you can change your perceptions, your attitudes, so that you don't need to break the precepts ever again. So amnesty in a family is really important. So I bow to virtue. The next time I bow down to peace. It's an incredible, powerful word, peace. Peace of mind. So you can be at peace with yourself no matter who you are and what you've done. Peace in the family, so you can have harmony, forgiving each other, and eventually, who knows, peace in this world. And you can have peace in a Buddhist society. Now, I've been in this place many times, many years, and I would come to the London Buddhist Vihara when it was over in Heathfield Gardens, before it came here. And there's sometimes, you know, there are problems in the Buddhist community, a split, misunderstandings between one another. I've been there and seen that. And that really is so unpleasant. Isn't it wonderful when everyone's in harmony and they see that, you know, they can come to a temple. It's not like a family who are just arguing with each other. The temple is in harmony. The monks are at peace with one another. And then we can take that further, have peace in our world. Why not? So peace is such an important thing for me that that's my second thing I bow down to. Peace inside, around and outside as well. But when it comes, you know, to being at peace with yourself, you know, this is actually where we have our meditation, we have our Dharma. Why can't you be at peace with yourself and accept yourself? One of the reasons is because we've got these demons in the past. These things which you did, which I know about. And these things which other people did to you, which, you know, really hurt you. And this is where I developed the simile of the trees in the forest. Now, there are many beautiful woods. I went for a nice walk this morning. And there's many beautiful woods in England. Even here in London, you've got these parks. You've got like Hampstead Heath. You've got Richmond Park. You've got, you know, Gunnersbury Park. You know, I used to spend a lot of time in there. And Burlington Gardens down the road. I had a good friend live close by there. There's so many beautiful parks where you can go and have a walk and see so many trees. If you ever you go for a walk in some of those big parks, can you please try and find a perfect tree for me? By which I mean one which is dead straight. Not leaning to the left or leaning to the right. Not crooked. Dead straight. With all the branches evenly spaced. With only green leaves on there. Not sort of mottled leaves or half eaten by insects and bugs. And with the bark all nice and smooth with no damage on it. And if you can find a tree like that, it will probably be in Kew Gardens probably, where it's all manicured. Or maybe Buckingham Palace or something, where every tree just has to be so right. But actually, even there, they probably don't have such trees, because such trees aren't natural. And also, they're not beautiful. When I go and walk in a forest, the ones which I like the most are the ones which are all crooked and bending all over the place, with the branches broken off, so there's little holes where the birds can nest. And there's beautiful different colours of leaves. I was fortunate when I was in Canada, it was the fall season, you know, the autumn, and there's so much forest there, it's the most magnificent sight. You know, the oranges and the reds, and there's still lots of greens left. It was almost a perfect time to visit Canada last week. And somebody told me that it was so orange in the forest that I could go for a walk in any part of the forest and this robe would be perfect camouflage. They would not be able to find me. The whole forest was this colour. And it was beautiful. And when I go and see the barks, you know, the trunks of the trees, you know, they're all knobbly and scarred and they've got this tessellated bark on it, a bit falling off, and little blotches here and blotches there. That's beautiful. And I always say it's the damaged trees in the forest, the bent and crooked ones, are the most delightful and beautiful. Now use that simile for human beings. You're all bent and crooked. Some of you more than others. You've got blotches on your skin. And you can't really hide it from makeup. It's under there. Little pimples and other stuff. And you've got a lot of pain from your past. This is the damage on the barks of the tree. Every human being is what they call these days damaged goods. And if that's you, then you belong as one of the beautiful trees in the natural forests of our world. I and many other sensible people like you the most. Damaged goods are awesome. And what that means is you learn how to be at peace with yourself. Not by changing your past. When I was in Germany, because Germans have got this thing with forests. You know, there were forest people before. It's in their genes. They love forests. And I said, I've never seen a German person walk into a forest with some sandpaper smoothing out the barks of the trees. No one ever does that, or straightening them up. They love the crooked, damaged ones. And that's why, as a human being, now I love you, especially the ones which are really damaged. So stop trying to cure yourself and make yourself straight. Stop trying to get your husband and straighten him up and get rid of all his crooked ways. Stop just getting your wife like some supermodel so all the blotches disappear. It's a crazy thing to do. So instead we learn how to respect everyone. No matter who they are, and whatever's happened to you in the past, to respect that too. And never look at it as something which demeans you, which takes things away from you, which stigmatizes you, but things which actually add to your beauty. I gave a little talk on mental health issues in Germany, University of Hamburg, And I was saying that we stigmatize so much in life, not just mental health, so much so that we don't tell anybody what we've really got. I say, if you're psychotic, be proud of it. If you're schizophrenic, let everybody know. And be proud of it. So don't hide it. Don't be ashamed. And now you get onto tough stuff. If you've been raped, physically abused, don't stigmatize yourself and think you're a second-class person because of what happened to you. Let people know. You're a damaged tree in the forest. Just change the way you look, and that damaged tree is really gorgeous and beautiful. And you can be at peace with your past. You can never get at peace with your past by changing your past. You get at peace with your past by embracing it, by seeing it in a different way, not stigmatizing it, but actually even being proud of it. And this is why you can find peace. And one of the reasons why Buddhism becomes really powerful in this world, because I've been asked to go to some terrible places and teach people who've been tortured, I mean real torture, you know, in these dungeons, and actually get them out of that using these Buddhist methods. And all these psychologists and psychiatrists have been trying their best, get really impressed that somehow or other these Buddhist monks or the Buddha himself could see things so deeply, could actually provide an answer which works, which is effective. So some of these, especially refugees who come to our countries, their body is free but their mind is far from free. Their emotions are still chained to the dungeons of the past. And you can find the lock and the key to unlock and free them, not just physically but emotionally, so they can live a beautiful life in a beautiful country. And that's actually how you do it. Embrace the pain of the past. Don't stigmatize it. It's part of who you are. Don't try and cure it. Care for it. Which is the second little story about finding peace in this world. Actually, this is part of the last part, the last third bow, but I'll put it in now because I've already started it. Sri Lankan young man, again Sri Lankan young man, coming to the temple since he was young, became a doctor, like most Sri Lankans do. Half Sri Lankans are doctors, the other ones are engineers. That's what I think anyway. But every now and again you get this Sri Lankan who does something else in life. That's really interesting. Dentist maybe, I don't know. But anyway, this guy, you know, he went to medical school and, you know, he's always a really nice fellow. And when he graduated and got qualified as a doctor, his first year in the hospital as a resident, I think they call him residents, he had a traumatic experience. And he came to me basically wanting to resign and start a new career. He couldn't stand being a doctor again. Because what happened, one of his patients, which was a young woman, maybe about 23, 24, had some sort of sickness. He was the main doctor looking after her, and she died. He wasn't at fault. You know, in a really specialist probably couldn't have seen what was happening, but still he felt guilty. And what was worse, he had to tell the husband, to tell him. And as a young couple, you know, only 3 or 4 years marriage, and they really loved each other. You know, they were obsessed with each other, totally devoted to each other. And he had to bear the news to the husband. The wife you love so much has died. You haven't got a wife anymore. And even worse, they had 2 young children. And your kids haven't got a mother. And that hurt him so deeply. He said, I can't do that anymore. It's one of the worst things a doctor has to do. And when he came to see me, I could figure out the problem straight away. I said, your problem is that you think a doctor has to cure people. That is not the job of a doctor. The job of a doctor is not to cure. If you think that's your purpose in life, you're going to fail many, many times. Like all doctors have to fail. But I said, if you realize that your job as a doctor is not to cure, but to care, it's just changing one letter, then you never need to fail again. You can't always cure people, but you can always care for them. And if you always care for them, even when they die, they've been cared for. They know they've been cared for. The family knows. The doctors and nurses have cared for our, you know, father, our mother, our kid. That changes the whole experience. And you never need to feel a failure again. And also, as I think, you will probably all intuit, if you care for a person rather than always trying to cure them, their survival rate will increase significantly. And when I told him that, he was back in hospital the next day, caring for people and not curing them anymore. And now he's a specialist with his family, a very successful young man. Now that story was powerful because it wasn't just doctors, it was like wives. Your job is not to cure your husband, to straighten out his bent crookedness, is to care for him. And you find if you care for your husband, he will straighten out by himself. If you try and straighten him, you're in big trouble. Same with your wife. You know, husbands always trying to cure their wives and just cure them of spending too much and doing too much. There was one husband that, when it was his wife's birthday, you know, he gave her plastic surgery. Yeah, that's right, he cut up the credit cards. That's what we call plastic surgery these days. She's spending too much. So stop trying to cure, you know, people. Care for them. And that is a powerful way of making any situation so much better. You're caring for the tree rather than trying to straighten it. But anyway, that's having peace in your family. Now, where I actually live, just in number 17, Edendale, Creswick Road, it's still there. And it was a really, really small council flat. And I love small houses. One of the reasons is I had to share a room with my brother. You know, just two little beds in a tiny room. And my mum and dad were in this small apartment. They argued, like any couple, but they could not escape from each other, and they could not escape from their kids. So after about half an hour at the most, they made up. And the most important thing, they made up in front of my brother and I. And I always remember that, you know, because as a kid, having a mother and father arguing just really hurt. But then I saw them together, kissing and hugging and forgiving each other. And that's how I grew up. What I learned from that is arguments are natural. We'd always argue from time to time, seeing different things. But the most important thing is the making up. Especially in front of the kids. Because they teach you. There are differences of opinion. But in the end, we make up because we are a family. We are a community. And I think that example, the wars in our world, say between the Muslims and the rest of the world, yeah, we're arguing. Wouldn't it be wonderful if we could make up? That'd make everyone cry. Now that's possible because that's what I learned, but only because I was in a small house. If you're in a big house, you never see that. You never have to see that. And there was a lady, someone sent me this from some newspaper here in the UK. She won the British lottery. £47 million she won. Would you like to win the British lottery? No, don't. Because when she won the British lottery, £47 million, the first thing she did was to buy a big mansion in Sussex, you know, a huge palace. And she sold it 1 year later at a great loss. And when somebody found out, they did an article about her in the newspapers, which is where I heard about it. And the sub-editor of the newspaper, he gave it the title, Honey, I Can't Find the Kids. Because that's what it's like in a big mansion. You know, your daughter is in one part of the mansion, your son is in another few rooms, your husband, you don't know where he is, he's somewhere in this huge house, and you're in another part of it. You've got so many rooms, you never see each other. And that broke up her family. And she was wise enough to notice that and buy a really small house, a semi-detached, I think it was somewhere, £47 million, he buys a semi-detached house, small, because she wanted to see her kids many times every day and see her husband too. For those of you, you know, from Sri Lanka or from Asia who've grown up in small houses, they weren't comfortable. And maybe you maybe slept three or four kids to a bed. Like I found out my sister-in-law, you know, she had three bedrooms in their house that was in Tottenham, and the three girls slept in one bed, the four brothers in another bed in another room, and the parents had the third room. You can imagine what happens when you spend your life in your young areas sleeping in the same bed with your two sisters, the same bed with your three brothers. You really learn how to love each other. You've got no choice. And that's what happened with my brother. Sharing a room together for about 18 years until we went to university. Yeah, we fought, but we had to make up because there was no escape. And now I just spent, a couple of days ago, spent a wonderful 24 hours with my brother. And we love each other to bits. Why? He's not a Buddhist. I took him to a Buddhist talk one day. It was the last time I was here. I gave a talk in this one of our members, our friend's house. And you know, he told me, this friend, he said, Ajahn Brahm, so I want to give you some really English food for a change. Not Sri Lankan food, not Thai food, English food. So he made us bangers and mash. Remember bangers and mash? It's like sausages and mashed potato. Sri Lankan people will think that's yucky food. But if you were born here, that is the tops. That is hot cuisine for a Londoner. And as soon as my brother heard I was going to get bangers and mash for lunch, he came along. Not for listening to Buddhism, but for the food. Because, you know, the reason was because his wife would never let him eat that. You know, she said it was bad for his health and he was getting fat. But when he came for me, his wife never came, so he ate as much as me. I only eat one meal a day. He was going to have dinner that evening. I couldn't believe how much he put down his throat. But that's my brother. And of course, after the food, I gave a talk, you know, about Buddhism. And he had to listen because he had no place to go. He had to do something for the pleasure of the bangers and mash. And then afterwards, I was going to give another talk at the London Buddhist Society. This was the last time. I said, do you want to come along, brother? He said, no, that's enough Buddhism for me for the day. He's had enough. But you know, he's not a Buddhist, but, you know, we get on together. And he's quite happy to come listen to a Buddhist talk because we have this beautiful relationship together. So sometimes big houses, they separate you. You know, and your kids, if they've got separate rooms, they're deprived of love and friendship and learning how to live with each other. Why is it that in our world we find it so difficult to have friends? And we do find a partner so difficult to keep a partner. You know, if you've stayed in the same bed with your brother, you know, your sisters, you know, you learn how to get on together. It's like training for when you become married, you have to stay in the same bed with a snoring guy. You know, you've done that with your sisters. But whatever, you can see the benefits of small things. So, you know, the peace is most important. So when I bow to peace. And that means I always remember the importance of peace. Making peace. Trying to find a way of just solving conflicts in the world. Bringing people together rather than separating them. kids being able to sort of love their parents and stay with them so they have this beautiful, peaceful family. Isn't that wonderful? When you've got a big family and you don't have arguments with them, you're at peace with everybody. You don't need to agree with them. You don't even respect what they do. Just treat them as beautiful trees in the forest, all bent and crooked. And then you have this beautiful peace in the world. That's the second bow to peace. I always remember, peace is important when I bow. And the last bow is for compassion. And every time I see a beautiful, kind act, you don't have to do it. It's a stupid thing to do, but you do it anyway. Now, one of the reasons I'm here, because I'm stupid, because my wisdom is much weaker than my compassion. And sometimes you look what I'm doing. You know that I just fitted this in, squeezed it into my schedule. Tomorrow morning, flying all the way to Perth, land in the afternoon and give a talk on Friday night. There's no rest. I'm stupid like that. I'll be jet lagged, exhausted. Who cares? I'm going to be kind. See all my friends and give them a nice talk as best I possibly can. And whenever I see other people doing ridiculous compassionate acts, you come home from work, you're exhausted, and maybe a friend says, look, I really need your help. My car's broken down. Can you pick me up on the M25? And even though you're really exhausted, this is a friend. I'm going to do that. You're compassionate. Now that simple things like that are what makes this world beautiful. They shouldn't do that. People who are sick. And then they, can you come? I need someone to help cook a meal for me. And you're so good with your hoppers or whatever it is you eat. And actually you go there and help them, even though you're so tired and maybe even a bit sick. But you do it for them out of kindness. Now that sort of acts of compassion, that's what makes the world beautiful. I'm just trying to think of some acts of compassion of other people. One of those was, there was a Laotian refugee over in Perth. And sometimes when you have these refugees, people make these big mistakes. The rest of her family was sent to United States, to Oregon, to Portland, Oregon. And there's this one sister, daughter, she was sent to Perth. She was separated from her family just because of some clerical error. They're just so nasty when that happens. So she had no choice. She arrived in Perth knowing absolutely no one, with her family over in the United States. And after a few years here, she was a Buddhist, came to our temple. I remember her coming to me just crying her eyes out. Because she'd got, in those days, telegrams, not SMSs, that her mother was sick and dying. Can you please come to Oregon straight away? Your mother is dying. And this was a poor refugee girl. She was crying because she didn't have the money for the airfare. No savings. It was just hand-to-mouth existence as a refugee starting off in life with no other family. I know she was, because I know as being in Asia for 9 years, just how desperately that is important, even more important than, if you were an English person. If you're an English person and your mother was dying, say, in France, I mean, of course you'd go over there straight away. I am an English, but I also know Asia. For an Asian, it's doubly important. And she just could not go. And that was hurting her so much. And as I was trying to console her, there was another Thai girl who was out of work. She didn't have a job because she'd injured her back and her profession was a nurse. She just calmly just got out a checkbook and wrote a blank check, signed it, fill out the amount you need for your ticket, and handed it to this Laotian girl. And I knew this Thai girl could not afford that. But she couldn't, even worse, she could not afford not to give that check. Someone needed a ticket to go to the United States to see her dying mum. She realized how important it was. I don't care whether I can afford this or not. You need to go. Now, those are acts which are beautiful. Those are acts which bring light to the world. And you may read about all sorts of problems in the world, terrorism, economies, politics and all that stuff, but One act of kindness and compassion changes the whole idea of the world. The world has hope. The world has beauty. You know, sometimes young people tell me, "Said this is terrible, climate change, wars, lack of water, whatever is going to happen, this is a terrible, what sort of world have you left for us?" But when they see kindness, they realize, thank you, this is a beautiful world. So I worship compassion. So when I bow down a third time, it's for kindness, compassion, care. Because that is the third really, really valuable thing which I try to build always in my heart. People might say I've got a lot of that already, but you can always get some more. I'm very greedy when it comes to virtue, peace and compassion. Give me more, 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 please. Or rather I try and build more. So when I bow the third time, bowing to compassion, I keep remembering, this is important, Ajahn Brahm, try and be more compassionate. Don't think of your body or whether you're tired or whatever. If somebody needs you, just off you go. Give it to them. As much as you can. I know some women say, shop till you drop. Mine is being kind until you don't mind. Or something like that. And this is my three bows, which I learned how to do. When I tell Westerners that, it's incredible. They never bowed before, and they all bow, 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 bow. And the reason is because now they understand it. It's a ritual which they've now given a meaning to. And they can understand this is part of a little practice which is going to make them more peaceful, more virtuous, more peaceful, more kind. And they're going to create more of that in the world with their family, with themselves, with their offices and everything. It is a psychological powerhouse, bowing. And these days I can bow to anything. You know, Sri Lankan kids bow to their parents. And people think that's weird. Bowing to your mum and dad. How many English people bow to their mother and father? And you think that's totally culturally inappropriate. But I still make people do that in Australia. Because when anybody ordains, you know, a young man becomes a novice or a monk, or even a woman becomes a nun, in the ceremony we always invite the parents. Even the parents may be Christians or atheists mostly. And they come to the ceremony and think, this, you know, what am I doing here? You know, it's the first time I've been in a religious place for years. I don't really trust these monks and all this Buddhism business, but I have to be here because my son decided to become a Buddhist. I don't know why. Maybe he'll grow out of it. But they come anyway. And then one of the first parts of the ceremonies, I ask the candidate to go and bow to your mother and father and thank them for all they've given you, caring for you, feeding you, giving you a house, education. Bow to them and then ask forgiveness for any faults you've done to your mother and father since the time you were born. And it's beautiful because I see these Australian men weeping, tears running down their eyes, and the women, just even worse, seeing their son bow to them and seeing their son saying thank you and asking forgiveness. Absolutely beautiful. And then they said, okay, you can become a monk. I like this religion. And so it was one time I was invited to give a talk. I don't just go to Buddhist temples. I like to spread myself around, going to places where no monk has ever been before. And how many of you watch Star Trek? Or I watched it when I was a kid, but apparently it's still going. No Star Trek? You know that one? I remember it. Apparently it's still the same in the beginning, to say, to boldly go where no man has gone before. And I changed that for my motto, to boldly go where no monk has gone before. That's a boldly, you know, no hair. Boldly go where no monk has gone before. So to break new grounds. So one of the places I went was one of the top Christian schools. Not just to give a talk, but to give the talk at the assembly. You know, the religious service at a Christian school. You know, when you first, you know, go to school, You know, everyone comes in assembly, they do some hymns or something, and then the talk. And they invited me, you can give the sermon. I thought, yeah, I'm into for that. And so I have to arrive really early, you know, and then I was asked to wait outside with a chaplain, this Anglican chaplain, he was a canon, that's next down to a bishop. A canon, the bishop, and the headmaster and me. We waited outside for the teachers to settle down the school, maybe about 1,200, 1,500 kids in this beautiful hall. And then the principal, the headmaster said, we are now going to go in, and as we walk in, all the children will rise out of respect for us. He said, the chaplain and I will bow to the image of Jesus Christ. You're Ajahn Brahm, you're a Buddhist, you don't need to bow. And I love this moment because I decided to make a point. I turned to the headmaster, and as I said, I demand my right to bow to your Jesus. I really over-exaggerated it because I was making a point. And this poor headmaster was totally confused. But you're a Buddhist, what are you bowing to Jesus for? And I said, I can always see something in any figure which I respect and admire. And that's what I'm going to bow to. I'm not a Christian, I'm a Buddhist, but I can always see something in anybody which is beautiful and kind and compassionate. That's what I'm going to bow to. That part of Jesus which I like, not the rest of it, but that part which I admire. And so when we went in, the three of us bowed. About 2 or 3 months later, that headmaster, who obviously had to be a very committed Christian to be a headmaster of a top Christian school, he came to our monastery, and with me, he bowed to the Buddha 3 times. Now that's beautiful. That is how we create peace and harmony in this world. And that is actually how we understand what bowing is. And that's, when I'd say that, everyone, every time they come in the temple, bow, bow, bow. They can't bow enough. They really get into it. I have to tell them to stop. Don't bow so much. But they get into it once it's understood. So when we understand the rituals, they become incredible. They're wonderful things to do. The same with the chanting. We have, oh, I better stop soon. We have the chanting which people do. You know, is that really good to have all this chanting, 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 chanting all the time? Does it really, really work? Why do we do chanting? Now, when I lived in Acton up the road before I became a monk, like every other English person, I watched football, soccer. And the team which I followed, I wish I'd have chosen better, was Fulham. In Craven Cottage, I used to go there just religiously. That was my religion before I found Buddhism. And it was actually one of the reasons I became a monk, was they kept on losing. Just too much suffering. Just like the Sri Lankan cricket team. Too much suffering, so become a monk. But one of the things I always remember, you know, when you were watching the football team, you were cheering in the stands. Shouting, cheering, even chanting for your team. And that uplifted them. That gave them energy, purpose, even hope. And that's one of the great powers of chanting. The same sort of thing which happens in a football stadium. The same thing which happens when maybe your daughter is playing a tennis match, you know, in a school final. Mum and Dad are there, and they can hear them. Come on, darling, you can do it. And that means that that little kid actually wins because of the support, the power of the mother and father. And sometimes that chanting has the same power. You know, monks, sometimes really busy monks which you really respect, you know, they're coming to your bedside. They're spending all that time just with you and chanting. You know, it doesn't really matter if you understand the chant or not. When people say, well, why don't you chant the chants in English or something so we can understand what you're chanting all the time? You know, why do we have to have this ritual always chanting in a foreign language? And there is a good reason for that. And that reason you can understand when I say that I do get tired sometimes, I do work too much, my compassion is much stronger than my wisdom. And I was doing a marriage ceremony, again for a couple. And I was so tired that when I did the chanting, I did the chanting for funerals instead of the marriage. You know, we all make mistakes sometimes. So I did a special chant reserved for funeral services when two people were getting married. But because it was in Pali, they didn't know. And they said, oh, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. What wonderful chanting. Thank you very much, Ajahn Brahm. And you know, they're still together. It worked. Because it wasn't the chanting, it was the fact that I was really supporting them. And my kindness, and the fact that there's many people in the stands shouting for you. Because those footballers on the ground, they can't hear you. You know, they don't know what you're chanting, they just hear this noise. You know, when the Sri Lankan cricket team are playing, they're focusing on the ball being bowled to them, or, you know, catching the ball. They're not really paying attention to the crowd, but still it supports them, encourages them, even if they don't understand what's being said. That is like the chanting. It really uplifts you sometimes. If you're a monk or a nun, you know the Pali, then it's beautiful chanting. Some of the Dhamma there is incredible, it's exquisite. So when I do the chanting, some of these paritas we do, this chanting, they are actually teachings of the Buddha, and some really beautiful teachings in there. And because of that, that sometimes, it's happened to me a few times, I started chanting, I can't go on. Because, you know, it's like listening to something which is really incredibly deep and inspiring. I can't chant anymore because it just gets into you. So some of these paritas are incredible if you understand the Pali. But that's, you know, for those people who've done that study. Even if you haven't done the study, it still really works. But you know the other chanting which we do, the other sort of ceremonies, I always say that as Buddhism, we don't give a cradle-to-grave service. It's much more than that. You know, we actually chant when the baby's in the womb. And we chant after a person dies. So it's before the cradle, after the grave service. Really good being a Buddhist, you get much more. I was telling, because my friend in Cambridge, one of the things we did together was in the Psychic Research Society, you know, just exploring ghosts. I loved anything weird. I was a scientist. I wanted to find out, ghosts, do they really exist? And I was telling this story, it's a really good story. A couple of years ago, okay, and it's relevant because it involves a Sri Lankan couple, that this disciple, you know, had been following me for years, you know, on YouTube from Sri Lanka. Her brother got a really, really bad cancer. And it got so bad, the family decided to send him to Singapore. Maybe, you know, they could got some special doctors over there. In Colombo, it's good enough. It's more than good enough these days. But they decided to send it to Singapore. Maybe, you know, he could survive. But there's nothing the doctors could do in Singapore. You know, he was on the way out. So she called me in Australia. Ajahn Brahm, I've been watching you for a long time. Can you please talk to my brother? I know you're busy, but he's going to die soon. And I'm sure he will benefit from, you know, hearing some advice from a monk like you. So, of course, even though I didn't have any time to do that, so I did it. Compassion always gets me into trouble. But, you know, good trouble. I like doing it. But I talked to him. He could hardly talk at all. So it's more like he was listening, because he was paralyzed from the neck down and just about to die. You know, three nights in all, I talked to him, you know, in Singapore. And the fourth night, he didn't call. Or rather, his sister never called, because he died that night. And the following night, the fifth night, she called to tell me the news. He died last night. But then she told me the weird one. She said, about 6, 8, 10 hours after he died, I received an email from him saying thank you, especially to Ajahn Brahm. About 8 hours after he was dead. And before then, for days or weeks, he'd been paralyzed from the neck down. It was an email from beyond the grave. And She wouldn't lie to me. There's no reason to make that up. That was true. And being a monk who is just at that time new to technology, I finally worked out what Gmail really means. Ghost mail. That's what Gmail means. So if you have an old mother who dies, an uncle who passes away, check your email account. It's nice being able to be kind and just to help out, because that really, you know, that's why we do this. And I was saying that one thing the monks are really good at is getting rid of ghosts. Because there are some hauntings sometimes. And this happens so often. They get the Christians in, first of all, maybe the Taoists in, maybe all sorts of other people in it, but nothing works. You get the Buddhist monks in, it works straight away. We do. We've got the best ghost-busting business in town. Absolutely true. And I still remember I gave a talk in Kuala Lumpur about Buddhism and ghosts. That was the title of the talk, and you think you've got a big crowd here. Everybody was packed into the hall. Even the ghosts came to listen. And that was in the temple which was run by the great Sri Lankan monk, Dr. K. Sri Dhammananda in Malaysia. He's an amazing monk. And he told a story that in Kuala Lumpur, close by to his temple, there was a haunting. And they tried to get the Christians in to get rid of the ghosts, never worked. They got the Muslims in, never worked. Got the Taoists in, it never worked. And eventually they got him in to get rid of the ghosts. It worked. But not quite good enough. Because the day after he chanted in this house to get rid of the ghost, the neighbor came. Because the ghost had only moved next door. Absolutely true. I'm not making this up. You can't make these stories up. They're actually true. So he had to go into that house, and to solve any problems in the future, he went to every house in the street to make sure the ghost never to move next door again, but actually went right out of the neighborhood. So that's what happened. So sometimes the chanting is actually sometimes works. So, you know, it's okay to have these little rituals sometimes, as long as we don't overdo it. And once we understand why it works and how it works, of course, Westerners in Australia, people love that chanting. And they keep coming again and again. And in fact, you know, where our monastery is, you know, is in the countryside, outside of Perth. It's a farming community. And when I had the local councillors come down, these local councillors, they've got a lot of power. They can actually give us the building approvals or make life difficult for us, like councils can, even here over in... It's Ealing Council here, isn't it, still? Yeah. They can cause a lot of problem for the temple if they want to. So when they came to have a look, I told them about the power of chanting. I got out some scientific research from Taiwan. Because they said in Taiwan, a duck gives an egg once every four days, on average. Ducks in Taiwan lay an egg once every 4 days. But if they are played Buddhist chanting, they lay an egg once every 3 days. The Buddhist chanting, I said, increases the productivity of the cows in the dairies, the chickens in the farms, and probably the people as well. You see, that's how powerful it is. And so when I explained to the farming community councillors that the chanting in our monastery was going to increase their profits in their farms, they all voted to pass all of our building approvals. And we had a great time. But it's also, when I taught it like that, they laughed. And they thought, these monks, you know, they're fun. They're just like ordinary human beings. And when we actually made this cultural contact with our local community, you know, with kindness, with laughter, that meant they trusted us. So when Buddhism actually can adapt to the local community like that, and we're just part of the community, and they just love us over in Australia, then our rituals have got a purpose. The purpose of harmony, mutual understandings. And don't ever think, I sometimes get criticized, monks aren't supposed to laugh. Why is a monk funny? And the reason is because this is in the Dhammadhyaya Sutta. When King Pasenadi, because every time in the Sri Lankan temple I have to get formal just to actually to give me some cred. You know, amongst these traditional Buddhists. And that is, cred is credibility. And that is Dhammadhyaya Sutta, where King Pasenadi went to visit the Buddha in the famous Jetavana monastery, the Jeta Grove. And the king went into the monastery, asked where the Buddha was, and they said, he's in his hut, you know, he's probably meditating, but you're the king. Now, if you knock on the door, he would almost certainly let you in. And that's what the king did. And as soon as the king went into the hut where the Buddha was, he bowed on the ground and started kissing the Buddha's feet. So what are you doing that for? You're a king. And the king said, yeah, but you know, you're my teacher. And you're like a father to me. And I love you. There was this beautiful pouring out of emotion, you know, of a student to the teacher, with all the gratitude of all the years this king had taken advice from one of the greatest teachers. And the king also said, and I love coming to this monastery. It just gives me so much happiness and joy to come to the temple. And that is when the Buddha said, why? Why do you enjoy coming here? There's other temples you can go to. And he said, because whenever I come into this temple, the monks are always happy and smiling. And that's when the Buddha said, yes, king, that is what you can expect when the monks have been practicing meditation and getting some understanding of the Dhamma. They'll be smiling and happy, which is why the king and so many other people wanted to go to the temple. So I tell funny stories, I make you laugh, I make you happy, because that will mean you would love coming to the temple. You and your children, and that will be for your benefit and happiness for such a long time. I've talked a lot, so now some questions. Thank you all for listening. Oh, come on. If you're going to clap, do it properly. Very good. As a teacher, there's nothing more depressing than have I wasted all this time just putting all the energy in. So thank you. That was a really good clap.